am thinking about graduation and also just some of the things we'd like to start covering in sermons. It's amazing how much our country has changed and how different the world is that high school graduates are entering today than 30, 40, 50 or more years ago. My father was born in 1923 and grew up during the Depression time. His father died about 13 months after my father was born. My father was the youngest of eight children, born when my grandmother was 40, but my grandmother had her first at age 16, so the eight were spread out. They grew up in a world of poverty like most of us would never comprehend in our experience. Certainly, when people today say they are in poverty, it means they can't buy a new cell phone until next month. But the poverty that my family, my father grew up in, was typified by many that lived in their little tiny town of Hillary, Illinois. On the west side was Peabody Coal Company, and the Peabody Coal Mine was digging in the ground in Vermilion County, Illinois, and most of the men worked at the Peabody Coal Company and made a scratch wage, especially during the Depression era. On the east side of town was the Western Red Brick Company. The Western Red Brick Company was the largest brick maker in the world at the time and made a large percentage of the little red bricks that you see so common in many Midwestern cities. Cleveland, Cincinnati, Chicago, Pittsburgh, so many of them have massive numbers of large buildings built with the little red bricks, and a large percentage of those came from the Western Brick Company in Danville, Illinois. Wages there were also pretty meager. Since there were no welfare programs or systems of assistance, my grandmother had to get by as she could. So the older kids were out picking berries all summer. My grandmother took in laundry from other people. You can imagine having eight of your own children and then doing laundry by hand with a big mallet in one of those old spinner type or press type wringer washing machines for 10 cents a load. For swimming, they just went down and did things like swim. One of my favorite pictures of my father is he's standing there at about 11 years old and wearing a pair of cut-off blue overalls. And that was before he had his first pair of underwear. He never owned underwear until he was about 14 or 15 because the family simply couldn't afford it. They felt like if you had your outerwear on, why would you need underwear? Taking a bath was an interesting experience. When I used to stay with my grandma Sexton, I experienced some of what that was like. We sat in a tub, a cast iron tub, because there was no plumbing in the house. We had to get water from the well. It was a hand well. We'd go out and start pumping it until it primed, and then we would run around and pump it some more until we got the buckets full. I'd bring them in, and Grandma would put the buckets on top of the wood stove and get it all fired up. So we would sit in this at 9, 10, 11 years old. I would sit in this little cast iron tub with about 1 inch of ice-cold water in it, shivering, and then Grandma would come in and pour a big pot of boiling water over us. And the water went, and then she'd pour another pot of cold water. And so we went from hot to cold, hot to cold, hot to cold, not knowing what was coming or what was worse. But we eventually got our bath. But when my father was growing up, he was the last one of the eight to get a bath. So by the time he got in the bath water, it looked more like chocolate milk than bath water. But that's what they grew up with. They can remember doing all sorts of things to make money, mostly meager amounts of money for long, hard work. During the time of the recession or the Great Depression of 1930 to 1936, radio became popular. Farms in America, the ones that didn't go broke, got by. Then World War II came. In 1940 to 1945, as you know, many millions, about 14, 15 million Americans signed up and left the farms of America. And they went off to fight a righteous war to stop the evils of Nazism and Imperial Japan. My father ended up being the first person in his family to graduate high school and the first person from his town he grew up in to graduate college, a town of about 500 people. Eventually went on to flying B-17s and other airplanes, B-47s, and had about 7,000 hours in jet time by the time he finally retired in 1962. My father, just so you might know, is still healthy for the most part. He turned 94 in April and celebrated 2 weeks later by winning a golf tournament. Winning means there's a golf tournament, golf club he belongs to in Florida, where about 15 to 20, as he calls them, youngsters get together and golf every Wednesday morning. He is a good, I think he's 14 years older than the next youngest man, but most of them are in their 70s, maybe a couple in their early 80s. They all pool in like $10 a piece, and then they have five categories of who wins. There's the closest to the pin, there's the longest putt, there's the winner by actual strokes, and the winner by handicap. And a good day for my dad is when he wins at least two of the categories, and if he can win three or all four, then he has a really good day. So not bad for 94 years old, and I hope that he continues healthier for many, many more years. But in the years that followed, the baby boom generation, of which I am one, events happened rapid fire in the 1960s and then on into the 1980s. There was a movie that came out a number of years ago called Forrest Gump. It had some scenes that were not right, some immorality in some cases. It wasn't necessarily the best. But for those of us who saw that movie, it was like reliving our childhood in many ways. The events of the Kennedy assassination, the Vietnam War, the assassination of Martin Luther King, the hippies generation, Woodstock, all of those events that happened almost in machine gun fire, it seemed like, in the 1960s and 70s, were all vividly portrayed in that movie and brought back a great deal of memories for many of us. Today, historians agree that the assassination of President Kennedy on November 22, 1963, may have been the greatest turning point in the history of this nation. After that, we had the Vietnam War. We had the nation that was united for a good 20 years after World War II, not only united in purpose, but also seemed to be united in agreeing on morals, what was right and wrong, and values for our country. It all began to come apart. Many of us remember the Vietnam War. It began in 1965 in earnest, accelerated to the Tet Offensive of 1968, the year when there were many assassinations, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, the Kent State riots, followed by Woodstock the next year. In the 1970s, the war came to an end, 1973, but that was followed by Watergate, by Jimmy Carter, the time of old ideas and standards being eroded and thrown away. So many things have changed since that time that it seems like it's almost the world has been spinning. I want to read a few little articles. I have time that I found some good articles, I think, that depict or at least describe what has happened. In reviewing the decade called the 70s, author George Packer said, "The children of the 1970s, having inherited a reflective cynicism towards authority without a cause greater than recycling or sacrificing more painful than gas lines, learned early to feel envy, shame, and resentment." So what he's saying was that the 1960s generation caused a reflexive cynicism against authority, political figures, religious figures, and authority figures of all kinds. Those children of the 70s became academics and journalists, and inevitably a small historical literature on the decade has begun to accumulate. There's a book called The 70s, The Great Shift in American Culture and Society and Politics by Bruce Shulman. He says the great shift is away from the public-spirited universalism that gave America the New Deal and the Civil Rights Movement and towards the sovereignty of the free market and private life. In other words, people think that they as an individual are far more important than the collective goals that they might want to work together to accomplish. A similar argument put together by Bush speechwriter David Frum, he places the emphasis on the decline of traditional moral values, that what happened back in those years caused an earthquake to happen in what Americans thought was right and wrong. Many Americans, I should say, were concerned about the number of deaths in the Iraq-Iran war, or the Iraq and Afghanistan wars in recent times, but those figures pale into almost insignificance in comparison to the many that died in Vietnam. In 1968, a year that saw almost monthly upheavals around the world in the way of revolutions in Czechoslovakia and other places, 46 Americans per day died in Vietnam, 17,000 for the year. During that year, I was a paper boy. I remember every Friday or every Sunday, I forget what it was, there would be a list of all of those who had been killed that week in Vietnam. Sometimes the number was up over 400. I also remember in high school going to, when we walked into the front door of the high school, there was a wall there where they had the trophy cabinets and the various plaques, and at the end of the wall, there was simply a list of high school graduates from my high school who had died in Vietnam. And I think I only knew about five or six of them, but it was not unusual in 1969, 70, 71 to graduate, be drafted, and 6 months later be brought home in a box from that foreign country. Drama aside, 1968 should be torn from the historical fibers of history in the sense that it was the last days of perhaps the greatest generation's morals and standards. Those have been under attack ever since then by the culture in which we live. Now we are looking at a time when everything seems to be up for a target. Everything's up for grabs. I want to read here the 10 significant trends in America that have accelerated dramatically in the 2000s. But first, I think it's good to get some biblical background. The history of Israel and the Israelite peoples, unfortunately, has been one of changing standards, of changing society, changing culture. Let's go to Joshua chapter 23. Joshua chapter 23. Last week we discussed that the Israelites lived in Egypt and that they were subject to the various gods of the Nile River. But we find that when they got into the promised land, they had been schooled well by Moses. They had been led well and schooled well by Joshua and the Levites that were set up in the promised land to teach the principles that were left to them in the five books of Moses. But we understand from the chronology that the people of Israel had a short memory and that they very quickly, after the passage of years, turned back to idolatry. Joshua chapter 23 and verse 1 says, "It came to pass a long time after the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies round about that Joshua was old and advanced in age." Recall that he and Caleb did not age during their 40 years in the wilderness, that they were physically the same age as when they went into the promised land to spy it out and came back and gave a good report where the other spies gave a bad report. Joshua called for all the elders of Israel, for their heads, for their judges, and for their officers, and said to them, "I am old, advanced in age. You have seen all that the Lord your God has done to all these nations because of you, for the Lord your God is he who has fought for you. See, I have divided to you by lot these nations that remain to be an inheritance for your tribes, from the Jordan, with all the nations that I have cut off as far as the great sea westward. The Lord your God will expel them from you and drive them out of your sight. So you shall possess their land as the Lord your God has promised." So God, through Joshua, gave them the promised land. And the record of that, the record of that is in the book of Joshua, although it ends with the fact that they had not completely eradicated all of the other peoples in the land as they were supposed to have. Verse 6 says, "Therefore be very courageous to keep and do all that is in, that is written in the law, the book of the law of Moses, lest you turn aside from the, it to the right or to the left hand." So they had Genesis through Deuteronomy. They had the books of Moses. And Joshua told them here to be very courageous to observe that. Verse 7, "Lest you go among these nations, those who remain among you, you shall not make mention of the name of their gods, nor cause anyone to swear by them, nor shall you bow down to serve them." But verse 8 says, "You shall hold fast to the Lord your God as you have done this day." Well, the answer is, it didn't last very long, did it? Down in chapter 24, in verse 31, it just says very plainly, "Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. So those who knew Joshua, Joshua himself and his generation, those who knew him were very loyal and were able to continue. But things changed as soon as that generation died off. Over in Judges chapter 2, just a couple pages over, Judges chapter 2 beginning in verse 7, so the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. Now Joshua the son of Nun was a servant of the Lord. He died when he was 110 years old. And they buried him within the border of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the mountains of Ephraim, in the north side of Mount Gaash. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. So generational change resulted in idolatry, resulted in a very different culture for Israel than what they had had during the time of Joshua and the men who had known him. Things change sometimes very quickly. Sometimes it takes a long time. But this change of going after idolatry seems to be an up and down history of Israel that has been repeated often. And here we are in a time when our nation has not only repeated all of those sins, but we rejected God just as surely as they did. How things are changing is hard to understand without a reference. Many of our youth who are graduating today don't have enough years of reference behind them. And unless they have taken upon themselves to study history and to read biographies significantly, they are going to find it very difficult to have a frame of reference. You've probably all seen, like, Waters World and some of the interviews on TV. Jay Leno used to do this sidewalking thing. They would ask people the simplest of questions and get some very unusual answers. In fact, some that were almost bizarre. This article says there are 10 significant trends in North America that have accelerated dramatically in the 2000s, since the year 2000. And they are accelerating at a pace like the world has never seen because of modern-day electronics and communication. Number one, it's connection. By far the most significant acceleration is that our technologies of how to connect to each other and to information. In 2000, there were 97 million mobile phones in the United States. 2010, 293 million. Who knows how many there are today, 7 years later. We used to use technology to enforce our embodied relationships, but now technology has become its own relationship link. People have connections with each other on Facebook or on some other social media when they've never met. But the electromagnetic nervous system now has grown to match the physical infrastructure transport system in our country. That they're saying this electromagnetic system that connects everybody is just as important as all the roads and bridges that we have. Another is place. Oddly enough, people do not want to move anymore. Travel has not gone up much since the year 2000. There are about 2.7 billion miles driven by Americans in the year 2000. That number now is just barely over 3 billion miles, but the number of drivers is much higher. What it means is the average person is driving less. They're staying at home sometimes to work. They're staying at home because they're retired or they're simply living closer to their place of work. A staggering statistic that he quotes here is that in the year 2000, there were about 4,500 commercial flights. That's how many had to be stopped on September 11th, 2001. And 16 years later, the number of commercial flights flown in the United States is still 4,500. So people are not flying anymore as far as miles or number of seats or commercial flights in the air. We're simply staying home with a large number of people and doing more work here if we possibly can. And for those of us who have used, you know, WebEx or GoToMeeting or some of the other online systems, those meetings obviously have their weaknesses, but they are being used quite often all over the country. Another trend is cities Cities are growing rapidly. Rural America is not. The revival of American cities was already underway in 2000, but by the year 2020, you'll have seen unbelievable changes in American cities. The city with the largest number of tower cranes today is Seattle. There are more tower cranes. Seattle looks like one big porcupine when you drive up through there. And there are quite a number of things going on here in Portland. But what's happening is these cities are becoming mega cities. They're talking about the Boston to Washington, D.C. corridor as being one town of 55 million before too much longer. And they're talking about, they kind of put these large cities that are within a few miles of each other or within 100 miles, whatever, and simply calling them megalopolises. Fourth, the end of the majority. Cultural minorities have collapsed because now everybody is in a minority. We are all minorities now. Evangelical Christians are a minority. Liberal Protestants are a minority. Catholics, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, agnostics, atheists are all now minorities. Republicans are minorities, so are Democrats, so are independents. There may never have been a society in history that was as culturally, religiously, and politically diverse as the United States is today, except perhaps the later Roman Empire. There are few models on how such a diverse community can sustain itself, and there are plenty models for failure. Polarity, number five. One great change in our society is that people are becoming stronger at believing what they believe, and the walls that are resulting from that are very obvious. We use the technologies of connection and commitment to place ourselves into a more tightly homogenous subculture. Refugees, both virtual and real. Republicans become more Republican. Democrats become more Democrat. Salon lost ground to the Huffington Post. CNN lost ground to Fox News. The president elected on a promise of unity presided over years of ever sharper rhetoric of division. Hipsters got more hip. Reformed became more truly reformed. So we live in a time where because perhaps as a result of all the technology and communication, people are becoming more polarized, which means more divided, which means they agree on less and are perhaps less willing to contribute to the benefit of others or to cooperate on mutual projects. There is one individual in the Bible I think would fit right into our time. Let's go over to 2 Samuel chapter 14. You know, they say we live in the selfie generation. We certainly have a time where we have health clubs, all sorts of plastic surgery, a time where people are very concerned about their looks, very concerned about how they might appear. Some say that the social media exists to give everybody an audience and provide a certain amount of star status or celebrity status for anybody who has a page apparently with lots of looks and lots of likes. For many, many years, people could look at themselves only in the mirror, and mirrors provide, it's actually an opposite of what you look like. The visual mirror is a reflex. A mirror image is left to right reversed. So what we have today are called selfies. We have people extending their cameras out, or they have these sticks, they extend their cameras out so they can get themselves and two or three people. I don't know if you've ever been hit by one of those. We were going down a trail, going on a hike down in California a couple years ago, and going down this kind of a narrow trail down to this river, and these people are down there with their selfies just whacking people that are on the trail, and there's nowhere to go because they got these big sticks with their cameras on the end or their cell phones. But their estimates as high as 20,000. The number of selfies that the common youth today will have taken of themselves by the time they grow up. Here's a guy that would love to have had selfies. In fact, he created selfies of himself in verbal images to other people trying to get a following. 2 Samuel 14, let's begin in verse 25. Now in all Israel, there was no one who was praised as much as Absalom for his good looks. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. And when he cut the hair of his head at the end of every year, he cut it because it was heavy on him. When he cut it, he weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels, according to the king's standard. I don't know how much that would be, but apparently it must have been a lot of hair. And I don't think Mr. Laux or I have to worry about doing that much in the next few years. But this guy grew a lot of hair and apparently cut it once a year, and it was quite a thing of beauty. To Absalom were born three sons and one daughter whose name was Tamar. But Absalom was consumed with himself and with being a celebrity, or in fact, being king. Over to chapter 15 and verse 1. After this had happened, that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now you have to stop and consider, what would he have done if he would have had a laptop and a Facebook account? He would have done whatever, you know, these little dancing things they do where they go viral. They say that all the stars now are these little things. This one guy was a pogo stick. You know, you remember a pogo stick? We all used to have those. Then our mom made us get rid of them after we chipped our teeth on them. Remember those things? There's some guy doing some sort of somersaults and it went viral for millions of hits and all of a sudden he's a star. But I think Absalom would have done something like that had he had the opportunity. Because he provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. They were all announcing, Absalom is coming, Absalom is coming. And he would rise early and stand beside the way in the gate. People coming in and out of the town, he would talk to them. And whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, Absalom would call to him and say, what city are you from? And he would say, your servant is from such and such a tribe in Israel. Now they knew Absalom was a son of King David. He was a prince. Absalom would say to him, look, your case is good and right, but there is no deputy of the king to hear you. You know, in other words, the king, you know, King David's just simply too busy. He doesn't have time for little people like you, and he's not concerned enough to deputize me or somebody else to take care of him. Moreover, Absalom would say, oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, that I would give them justice. So he's building a following here. So it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. And in this manner, Absalom acted towards all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. And it looks like this went on for about 2 years. So he was doing the ultimate selfie at that time, the ultimate selfie that he would have opportunity to do, of course, would have been much different. But the story of his, or the takeoff from all of this, is that this trend towards individualism, this trend towards me first or a self-centered life, has been going on ever since the 1970s, perhaps even earlier in the 60s, where people were simply told, if it feels good, do it. It's all about you and fulfilling yourself. And this selfie generation is much different. It's going to be much different in consequences to what we have had in previous times. It may tell us why there are so many who are willing to be traitorous in our nation's capital and not only leak things they shouldn't, but sell secrets to the enemy, whatever those things might be. We also have the specter of tattoos and body piercings that people use. They say that's all about me being myself. And, of course, that's a big, big challenge because they have to live in a real world with other people. And, in fact, your success in life often is a result of how much you serve and please other people. Number 7 of the major trends that are covered in this article is the onslaught of pornography. He says, beneath it all was porn. Pornography originally was sold as visual art, but in the 2000s it became ubiquitous. Superimposed on every image of our own bodies and the bodies of our friends were the ideal bodies of pornography and its close cousin, advertising and popular culture. Each day, pornographic sites have more hits than Amazon, Netflix, and Twitter combined. Over 2 billion web searches a year, 30% of all internet traffic, 20% of all mobile device searches, 90% of all teens are exposed to it by the time they're 16, and 56% of all divorces involve one or the other spouse being involved in pornography. I want to go back to Job, the book of Job, chapter 31. You know, sometimes we think we're dealing with new issues. We're dealing with something nobody's ever dealt with before. But Jesus Christ warned us that he who looks after woman he's not married to with lust sins in his heart, commits adultery in his heart, It was extant, obviously, back then when, for all we know, women pretty much all wore just great big huge robes. They didn't have the designer clothing of today that often is so improper. Job chapter 31 in verse 1 once again shows us that Job contains many principles of New Testament Christianity. And the teachings found in the book of Job, and especially the prophecies found in the book of Job, are simply confirmed all throughout the rest of the Bible, even though this is by far the oldest book in the Bible, chronologically speaking. In chapter 31 and verse 1, Job says, I made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? So Job understood the principle of not lusting after a young woman. He understood that he had to make a covenant with his eyes to stop that from happening. Today we have just the opposite going on in our nation. It's like a big scythe that is cutting down a whole generation of youth. But it still remains underground. It is still a subject of shame, even among the most secular and urbane. Our culture seems to have dropped back from some edges of the abyss. Although watching any shows on television or movies, you might not think so. Number 8 is, and we'll come back to the issues with the entertainment industry in a minute, but I want to finish what he has here. 8, this is trend number 8 of the past 20 years, is informality. Things becoming informal that used to be a measure of respect signified by formality. Men untucked their shirts, billionaires wore jeans, chairing business meetings. The most powerful CEO in America was known as Steve. Indeed, informality was now a sign of privilege. Only low-status workers wear uniforms. Indeed, the ubiquity of the camera meant that everyone, including celebrities, politicians, business leaders, people who in past decades would have been insulted by privilege, was caught off guard, meaning that status now accrued to those who would be the most artfully informal, rather those who could protect themselves from view. Most institutions with layers of tradition and deference accumulated over years struggle to stay relevant in an informed culture. It used to be that IBM was the greatest computer company in America. Anybody know what the IBM uniform was for men who worked there? It was a black pinstripe suit. Every man who worked for IBM for many, many years wore his black pinstripe suit with a white shirt. And I used to have a good friend, Harold Lee, that worked for IBM, and he always wore his IBM uniform. That was required whether they were going out to sell new computers or to work on existing computers. Now, if you go to a place like Amazon.com or other places, the workers are dressed in just anything goes attire. And certainly even the leaders of many of those companies, it's much like that. So most institutions who were based on a system of understood respect have had to adopt, had to do different things because of what has changed. Perhaps the most obvious casualty of the informality trend has been marriage. Marriage, with its vows and formal attire, became for many people a distant aspiration far on the horizon. Instead, it's been replaced often by cohabitation as the accepted gateway to adult relationships. We have had things in the news like the crisis in the Catholic Church with the sexual abuse. Various other things have been brought to the fore to where this rejection of formality has reverberated down through our society. And certainly it has affected our church. If you were to see pictures of the Church of God back in the 60s with congregations today, there would be some obvious differences. Another trend is large amounts of money, liquidity all over the globe. We have big dollar people. In fact, there are websites that now list daily who is worth the most, the richest people in the world and the many, many billions that they are worth. Money sloshes between the borders of nations and national regulators and politicians briskly, quickly reaching the levies of international financial standards. Those who could trade on volatility often made untold fortunes. Those actually needing to buy and sell goods often suffered. So on a larger scale than most of us will have experience with, this huge amount of money changing hands all over the world on a daily basis, it's a new thing. It's a new phenomenon. It didn't happen back in the 60s and 70s. Finally, complexity. There was a bull market and oversimplification, but things have also gotten much more complicated. Used to be men could work on their cars. They could work on their pickups. They could change things like spark plugs, points. Now, you open up your hood, it looks like 25,000 snakes wrestling. And you wonder, what in the world is under there that I could work on? Well, without the training and the materials and the tools, you simply can't. So you just take it into the dealer and go ahead and wince as you get this large bill for hundreds and hundreds of dollars. Now, that was an account of what happened the past decade. This short article here is by Sarwant Singh, and he tells what's coming up. This is his version of megatrends. Some of you might remember back in about 1984, there was a book came out called Megatrends, big, big bestseller, and it was accurate. It was about 90% accurate as to what was going to happen in technology and the revolution in jobs, in society in the next 20, 25 years. By 2020, number one, by 2020 there will be over 5 billion internet users, 80 billion connected devices worldwide. Number two, bricks and clicks. Most stores will have to go to online and open store sales. They simply cannot survive with bricks and mortar alone. The future of mobility is changing. Car companies will measure mobility and share, not market share. They will move away from just selling cars and provide mobility solutions, integrating public transportation, trains, other ways to get around. Car sharing will become commonplace. And he mentions here these large mega cities that are growing up, coming up all over the world. The social trends that are changing, the rise of the middle class, an aging population, reverse brain drain. He even talks about the coming halal economy, where people who provide products and services will target the large growing Muslim populations in the Western countries. Generational and political change in nations like India, with massive numbers of children being born. Perhaps the single child policy in China being done away with. Innovating to zero, despite the fact that many disagree with the concept and what is being done in the way of either what we call global warming or climate change, he believes the world is heading towards everybody focusing on their carbon footprint, whatever that actually means. The new word now is smart, not green. That would be smart cars, smart this, and smart that. That used to be called green, but now it is called smart. What I really want to get to is the next article, the marriage crisis and how marriage changed in the last 50 years, because that is where we are. I want to start talking about marriage a little more, and it seems like since 1995 we have had to address doctrine over and over and over, and we have not had, at least wise in my experience, the need to address the simple institution that God created called marriage. But in the past 5 to 8 years, we have sadly seen a large rash of divorces and families that have come apart in the Church of God, not only just in the young couples, but in some others. And of course, even the trend to get remarried right away. It has been a black mark and has caused a great deal of suffering. Just so you know, this is very personal with me. My parents went through an extremely bitter divorce when I was 8 years old, and divorce court was never over. And so I understand what it's like to be the rope in a tug of war. I understand what it's like to be the club in a fight between a man and a woman who have grown to hate each other's guts. I have known what it's like to take my little sister and hide out in the brush when my parents were fighting and throwing things. And I understand why God hates divorce, because of what it did to me and my sister and my brother, and the fact that thankfully God called me. I'm just so thankful. My wife will tell you, she's seen a lot of my family, and she tells me, she says, if anybody ever wanted to see what God can do with a wrecked family and take one person and rescue them, sometimes I feel like, who was that girl in the Addams Family? That she was kind of normal. Everybody else was kind of, you know, going off. But anyway, we've had way too many divorces, and because of that, I think we need to discuss the issue. I have asked Mr. Dick and Mr. Reeves to also address in coming sermons in the next month or so the roles of a man and what a man ought to be as far as a husband goes, the roles of a woman and what she ought to be. We have had just way, way too many people who are willing to walk away from a commitment that's supposed to be between three, you and your spouse and God, and simply discard all of that as if it were just a real estate contract or an agreement to get your car fixed or something. We'll discuss that in a little while. But first, I want to talk about what this lady, the author's name is Aja Gabel, G-A-B-E-L. She writes, Brad Pitt and Angela Jolie have made headlines for all sorts of reasons, but one of the biggest reasons was they finally decided to get married after living together for all of these years, and it made great big news. How sad is that? Only about half of Americans are married now. Marriage has become less and less in style. 72% of all adults were married in 1960. The age at which one first gets married has risen by 6 years since 1960, and now only 20% of Americans get married before the age of 30. The number of new marriages each year is declining at a slow but steady rate. Put simply, if you are an unmarried adult today, you face a lower chance of ever getting married, a longer wait, and higher divorce rates if you do get married. The Pew Research Center recently found that about 40% of unmarried adults believe that marriage is becoming obsolete. And it also says that of all those adults who believe marriage is obsolete, over half of them want to get married. So sort of a dichotomy here. While marriage is in decline, unmarried cohabitation is on the rise. 15 times the number of couples today live together outside of marriage than 30 years ago. Although those numbers are very hard to discern because very few people report to the government that they are simply cohabiting. Why should we care? Brad Wilcox, a UVA sociology professor and director of the National Marriage Project, argues that the institution of marriage still symbolizes core values important to intimate relationships. Marriage conveys a sense of meaning, purpose, direction, and stability that tends to benefit adults and especially children. People who get married have an expectation of sexual fidelity, and fidelity tends to engender a sense of trust and security. Wilcox says there is no kind of similar ritual marketing than the beginning of cohabitation. The question is, why has marriage declined if it is so beneficial? The answer depends on whom you ask, but every expert points to the women's movement of the late 1960s and 1970s. There were several milestones in the 1960s and 1970s that caused, or at least led to, the marriage breakdown as we see it today. The very first was a birth control pill, invented in 1960, made available to all by 1965. When talking about this invention, people often say it gave women more freedom, it gave them more of this and that, more choices, they could extend being single long into their 20s and 30s without having children. Essentially what it did was cause the breakdown of marriage and, of course, morality. It became adultery with no consequences, and no chance perhaps for that consequence. Miller says part of it was that the women were able to become mothers later, but part of it was they had more confidence and control over the timing of their fertility. Well, we all know we could talk about that for a long time. The availability of birth control is not the only social change. Abortion was made legal in 1973. And we all know the fallout from that. About 60 million that we know of innocent American babies have had their lives snuffed out, and certainly a great deal of wake, a great deal of result in the way of things like guilt and a lot of other consequences that were not considered. It says, for some sections of the population, there is not really a marriage crisis. The two things that matter the most in successful marriages and not getting a divorce. Number one is education level. College graduates are far, far less likely to divorce than non-college graduates. The most important, though, is those who are of the same religion, and not only of the same religion, but are pursuing their religion so that it is important. Sometimes some of these research centers come out with some pretty unbelievable things. And then there is a sort of a counter analysis. One of the most common statements is that Christians divorce at the same rate as non-Christians. A closer examination shows that's not true, because those who are, quote, claiming to be Christian and then divorcing are very often those who are not at all active in their faith. They simply might claim to be Christian, but they simply don't attend church. They don't try to live it. They are just claiming that on a tick-off box, I suppose, on a survey. It mentions here that the research in a book called Christians Are Hate-Filled Hypocrites and Other Lies You've Been Told is that couples who are active in their faith are much less likely to divorce. Catholic couples were 31% less likely, Protestant 35% less likely, and the list goes on. I'll mention two caveats he mentions here. The study also finds that religiously unaffiliated Americans and counties with higher divorce rates are the most likely to divorce. In other words, that it is partly because there is no commitment to a higher level of standard of truth or purpose in life than just simply self. He also mentions here that you often hear the statistic that 50% of marriages end in divorce. He says that's because people love bad stats. So that statistic has never been proven, nor has it ever been actually taken from a controlled group that would lead to that conclusion. He said the truth is it's often much more complicated than that. That those who are serial divorcers who get married and divorced over and over and over skew it, and that there are other facts where those who were surveyed simply were not part of an accurate cross-section group. Here are a couple of stats from the book Surprising Secrets of a Happy Marriage. 53% of very happy couples agree with the statement, God is at the center of our marriage. 93% of struggling couples disagree with that statement. So 93% of struggling couples said God is not the center of our marriage. She writes, highly happy couples tend to put God at the center of their marriage and focus on Him rather than their marriage or spouse for fundamental happiness and purpose. One I didn't have time to really get into or to read was that in one of these trends about individuality is that oftentimes people today enter into marriage to fulfill themselves. In other words, they enter in to get. They enter into marriage because they want to have whatever need they have fulfilled. They don't look at it in the sense of fulfilling the needs of their mate or fulfilling the needs of a higher calling, such as establishing a godly family or helping each other to attain God's kingdom, which is what the Bible says we ought to be doing. Instead, they enter into a marriage for selfish reasons, and they wonder why it doesn't last very long. Finally, the last trend we want to look at is the trend of media and the effects of the entertainment industry, which, as most of you know, has done a great deal to promote fornication, adultery, drug use, dishonoring authority, ever since really about the beginning of the 1980s or late 1970s. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 18. Let's begin in verse 15. It's been said that television is a way of allowing people you would never allow into your house, to do and say things you would never allow done or said in your house. I think there's a lot of truth in that. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, beginning in verse 15. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Certainly not. Do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? For the two, he said, shall become one flesh. And he who is joined to the Lord is one spirit with him. The basis of what Paul is saying is that your spirit needs to be joined to God, not to any act or any portrayal of adultery. Flee sexual immorality, verse 18. Doesn't mean play with it. It doesn't mean be enticed with it. Doesn't mean come close to it. Doesn't mean toy with it. It means flee, run, just like Joseph did with Potiphar's wife. You get up and run. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you? So we have a very direct command from the Apostle Paul to flee immorality, to flee adultery and fornication, yet We oftentimes allow it into our hearts, into our minds, into our houses through the entertainment industry because that's what they do. Just with the effects of media on our children, there's so much to be seen. There's a good place called healthychildren.org that lists the adverse effects of media on children and teens, showing that today's children and teens are growing up immersed in digital media. They're exposed to media in all forms, television, computers, smartphones, and other screens, and that the results of that are obesity, that they oftentimes have sleep problems. I know a doctor who often prescribes what they call a cell phone ectomy at night, because these kids will get in their bed and they'll text each other all night long. And then they wake up in the morning and they're so tired they can't go to sleep. And this particular doctor, actually Mr. Barrett, set up in Canada, told me at a conference a few years ago that frequently now he tells the parents who bring in children with teens with health problems, the first prescription is a cell phone ectomy, especially between 6 at night and 6 in the morning. And after a while, the kids actually go back to sleep. There, of course, is the problematic internet use where it becomes an addiction, the negative effect on school performance, risky behavior. Social media and television often portray drug use, alcohol use, adultery and fornication as something to be enjoyed by everybody with no consequences. We also have cyberbullying, and then this particular article here in healthychildren.org says come up with a plan and stick with your plan for your family so it does not affect you as much in that way. We don't really need to talk about illegal drugs. Illegal drugs, most of you know, are on the rise. The opiate industries are almost exploding because heroin is now almost the same price as a marijuana cigarette. In Clark County, Washington, over 1 million needles are given away every year free to intravenous drug users. That's just in Clark County, which would be about 4 needles per person that lives there. And since I didn't get 4, my wife didn't get 4, that's 8 that went to somebody else. But I have that. I know the person who gives those out, so I'm not telling you something that's inaccurate in any way. Disrespect for authority and, of course, the breakup of the family structure. But first, let's go to Acts chapter 2 and verse 40. I'll kind of skip over a few things here just for the sake of time. It's been worthwhile because it's wonderful to honor our graduates. I'll just tell you, I am concerned about the world they're going into. When I was graduating high school in 1972, the world was in trouble because of the Vietnam War, but we still had accepted standards. People still, for the most part, went to church. There was still right and wrong. Girls wanted to be pursued and play hard to get, and the vast majority of the ones I knew certainly wanted to be married as virgins and have a family and children and do all the things that a wife should do. That has changed so much. It was appalling when my own son was in junior high and high school how many girls would call or girls would try to contact him. And we had a family rule that no girls were to call my son. That was just the way it was. If he wanted to call somebody, that was up to him. But no girls were to call my house and ask to talk to my son. You should ask my wife sometime about the various rules we had for kids growing up. My wife, it was her favorite, we had our child labor law. We were the first ones to have a child labor law that I know of, and that labor law was that all children shall labor. And so if it was killing chickens or doing yard work or canning or making jam or whatever it was, that the children were required to labor, and they could not have some reason to get out of it, doing dishes, whatever it was. I'm sure many of your families were in the same mode. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 40, we talked about this sermon last week on the day of Pentecost. Peter, when he ended his famous sermon, he says with many other words, or Luke the writer says, with many other words he testified and exhorted them, saying, be saved from this perverse generation. Now, you read those words, and you think, well, yeah, Rome was pretty bad. But then you read the first part of Acts, and it says, Jerusalem was filled with devout men from 17 different countries. These were very religious, devout men who all understood a great deal about the Old Testament, about the Bible, certainly the books of Moses and Isaiah and the prophets. And all these devout men were there together, and yet he says, be saved from this perverse generation. And certainly the Greek culture, the Roman culture would have been very perverse. But he's simply telling a group of really pretty dedicated people to save themselves. So how much more true is it today for us than it was for them? Obviously, it's even more today for us than it was for them, because our perversion is seems like everywhere. We have to be on the guard against it. Satan, the devil, is a roaring lion seeking whom he can devour, and he has his sights set on each one of us, and especially those who are just out of those growing up years and mature years and then wanting to, you know, make their own way in the world. Let's end on Ecclesiastes chapter 11. You're all very familiar with this. It's so important. We've used this verse quite often as a theme for camp. It's so important in those formative years that people, our youngsters, our youth, as they're reaching 15, 16, 18, 19, the years 20, 25, that they make a commitment to God to live the right way. Mr. Armstrong said many times that the years between age 16 and 25 are the formative years of the rest of your life. That it is in those years when you form the kind of person you are going to be, when you make the decision often as to who you're going to spend your life with and what kind of education you're going to get, what kind of career you might be having, that those years, those formative years, are so important. And when they are thrown away or neglected or simply let go to waste, it's very, very difficult to recover. Or worse yet, if those years are spent in self-destructive behavior, the scars that ensue can often last for a lifetime. So Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verse... Now let me see, where do I want to start at? Let's go back up to... Well, I guess I'll start in verse 12. Let's just start in verse 12 and verse 1. I was going to start in verse 9. We can read 9 and 10 of chapter 11. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth. It is a time to have fun, a time to rejoice, a time to have great experiences, exhilarating moments. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth and walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. We all have these ideas that come into our heads when we're in that age in life. But know, for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. There are consequences for every decision. There are results for the rest of your life if we make the wrong ones and if you make the right ones. Time invested wisely now, principles learned and learned to be lived now, will pay off for the rest of your life. Therefore, put away evil from your flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. So be very careful not to get involved in evil, not to get involved in the things that are self-destructive in those years of youth. Chapter 12 and verse 1, remember now your Creator in the days of your youth, before the difficult days come. You know, it's kind of a trend now for, if you look on Facebook and other places, which I don't much, my Facebook page is my dog's page. My Stella Mae is my Facebook page, and I have that as connection with my children so I can see little videos and pictures of my grandkids. But my own experience with the Facebook page was one of being taken over and false things being said, so I just canceled it. But people today, especially teens, often talk about being under stress or having all of these challenges they sort of are kowtowed to. Really, the Bible says that when you're in your youth, the difficult days haven't come yet. And they really haven't. The difficult days will come when you get older, when you have real responsibility. It says, and the years draw near when you say, I have no pleasure in them. Well, most of us still have pleasure in this life. We like getting up in the morning. We still have a lot of things to accomplish and wonderful experiences to have. But there will come a time when there will be no more pleasure because of health, because of decline, because perhaps of not having much to live for in the sense of this physical world. But remember your Creator in the days of your youth, because you'll prepare yourself well for the challenges that come ahead. There will be challenges. There will also be wonderful things. So it's our graduation day. Verse 6 says, remember your Creator before the silver cord is loosed. Bottom line is, never forget your Creator. Never forget the God who gave you life, the God who gave you principles to live by, His commandments and truths, and the God who has provided for us in this time, a time of peace, a time of prosperity, a time when we have so many opportunities for education, for relationships, for building the kind of life that you want to have. Verse 13 says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is everything for a man to do. It's man's all. For God will bring every work in the judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil.